This seems like the Trump put on crypto. Like he came in on Sunday in an illiquid market and basically like put did a for those that don't know, the Fed put is basically like the Fed puts a stop under the market at some price level. And it seems to be that's almost like what Trump was doing with that tweet. It was like really, I don't know. I don't know how planned it was. I don't actually know. I'm personally somebody of the opinion that I don't really love the idea of a Bitcoin strategic reserve, particularly one that's done like out of the executive branch of the U.S. government. I would get behind it a little bit more if like it came out of Congress, like a Cynthia Lummis bill that's out there. If they want to go that route, I think that's the correct way to do it. I don't really like the idea of putting other assets beside like one. Like I said, I'm not really even a huge fan of a Bitcoin strategic reserve. Personally, I don't think it's needed, but adding all these other assets, ETH, Sol, Cardano, XRP. I'm just not a fan. Like at that point, why aren't we just buying tech stocks? Is the way I think about it, which is not a and basically this is the consensus opinion. Trump winning the election is what changed what was going on at the SEC. Gary Gensler was extremely hostile to the entire crypto industry. Like you said, regulation via enforcement, that is not how things are supposed to be done. The SEC is supposed to be a disclosure regulator, not a merit regulator. So theoretically, they shouldn't be saying this investment has merit. It's just like you need to disclose everything that could go wrong or right with this asset and blah, 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 all the risks, everything you can imagine. As long as that's disclosed, it's fair game. Now the SEC is dropping a lot of these cases. They are going to continue to go after fraud and market manipulation, things along those lines. And it's going to be a little more libertarian minded. It will be very interesting to see where they draw the lines on different things. Like, I don't think everything's going to get through. Like, we have filings for a 2x Melania meme coin ETF. Like, will that get through? Maybe. I don't know. I just don't think that, like, as much as Hester is very, like, liberal with this stuff, I don't know if she's going to allow that. So they're going to draw a line somewhere. People who are anti-Bitcoin and anti-ETF saying they're going to be soft hands. They're going to sell when there's dips. And yeah, they will sell when there's dips. That tends to happen. There'll also be some buyers when there's dips in the ETF market. But ETF users are like diamond hands people. Like for the most part, they're buying these things. They're expecting to hold it for a very long time. And that's what this chart shows. As far as I'm concerned, there's going to be pullbacks. And ironically, like I said, 2-3 steps forward, I would make the argument that it was more like 15 steps forwards and a step back and 10 steps forward. Like this is the most successful ETF launch we've ever seen.
James, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Joe. Happy to be here.
Absolutely. So obviously you work at Bloomberg Intelligence. You're an analyst for ETFs. And 2024 was a major year for, not just ETFs in general. Obviously, we had a great year for the market, but more specifically, Bitcoin ETFs and a couple of other crypto ETFs we saw launched, namely Ethereum. I want to talk to you about that. But before we do, yesterday afternoon or evening, Trump came out, said he was going to do, he said something extremely plain and forward, like tariffs, Canada, Mexico tomorrow. And today we have 25% tariffs on Canada and Mexico. So what do you believe the implications are for the U.S. economy after these tariffs? Do you think this is the right policy move by Trump, or where's your head at with this?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like a lot of people who have been very pro-Trump have been like, he's not actually going to institute the tariffs. If he does, they're not going to be 20% or higher. And now people have gone to actually tariffs are good. I'm kind of in the camp that I don't really like tariffs. I think it makes sense for certain areas of the market, right? If you're trying to do things like build up your, things, defense, agriculture, things. I mean, obviously we had an issue during COVID where we couldn't actually make enough masks and different other things, vaccines, stuff like that. So there are like, self-sovereignty things that kind of make sense if you're going to tariff an area to do it. Blanket tariffs of 25% with two of our biggest trading partners in the world. I don't know. It's a big shakeup. I'm just somebody who's more, I tend to be more free market in the way that I think about things. I think it could be inflationary. I know they say it's not inflationary. It's a one-time price hike potentially, but you never know how this is all going to play out. There's a lot of second, third, fourth order effects that could come from these things. There could be negative trickle down economic effects from these things. And obviously, like, I'm not an economist, like I cover ETFs, but you have to know how the economy works and finance works in general. And, I kind of get it. They're trying to be, America first, all these types of things. But I just really am worried about the trickle down effects that this could cause, namely inflation and hindering the economy.
Absolutely. So talking about that, obviously, the main thing is that economists warn about inflation leading to higher consumer prices. We're already grappling with eggs. My fiance and I went to Costco yesterday. They only had 900 eggs, actually on Sunday. So the busiest day for Costco, they only had 900 eggs. You'd only take two cartons. So this seems to be a problem, one that, you know, tariffs could potentially further exacerbate. Obviously, that's a supply chain issue. With this, you know, it could be even more inflationary. So we're seeing the market's negative reaction to this. Spoozer down 1.2%, NASDAQ's down 0.7%, Russell is down 1.7%. If you take a look at interest rates, you take a look at OIS, all the way down the curve, it's now pricing in close to 100 bips of rate cuts between now and January 2026. My coworker tweeted, well, Trump finally got his rate cuts. That's the art of the deal. So that obviously a lot's going on in markets right now between the equity reaction, the reaction in, you know, overnight lending markets that we can use to think about where the Fed fund futures rate is going. What are your thoughts on all of this? Do you think that this will have a material impact on the way the rate cutting cycle goes moving forward?
Yeah, it'll be interesting. I mean, obviously, if this actually does cause some like sustained levels of inflation, if there's like second, third order effects, it's going to be hard for the Fed to, you know, cut rates into inflation. There's, you know, stuff they're doing with immigration could also promote a little bit of inflation. So there's a lot of like converging factors here and crossing streams. So you don't know exactly how this is going to play out. But like you said, like we have on the terminal, you look at WIRP, World Interest Rate Parity Screen, and things are like we went from basically pricing potentially one cut in the middle of the year or sometime in the fall after we were pricing for a whole host of cuts in 2025. And now the cuts are coming back on the table. And you talked about like what's going on in the equity markets. I mean, ironically, yesterday, I mean, we're recording this on March 4th. Yesterday, if you looked at the markets, Europe was up big. Like they were up multiple percentage points across the market, specifically the German market, the U.S. market, the Americas market, Canada, everything was down pretty hard. But today, everything is down. I mean, the DAX is down almost 4% today. So even Europe is getting hit from all these things that are going on. So I don't know. It's really hard to know what all these impacts are going to be. I would say, like, specifically for risk assets, one of the problems with the U.S. market is, like, expectations for earnings were so high for U.S. equities. We went from, like, not really having super high expectations in 2023 and even in 2024. And then things like ramped up. And that's part of the reason, like the markets really go based off of like beating expectations, right? And Europe has been the opposite. They're like, there was nobody expecting anything to happen in Europe and in other parts of the world. There was like no growth priced in. And all of a sudden you see some growth. You see a lot of these German defense companies spending money. So that those areas where the markets are doing very well because like they're beating expectations because they had virtually no expectations. So I think a lot of these things that we're talking about could really impact the earnings of some of these companies, and particularly because the earnings expectations were so high across the consensus estimates, the fact that we just might not meet those earnings could be like we might have like a choppy year or a choppy few months in the U.S. And risk assets obviously impact crypto as a whole. So it'll be interesting to see. It's like funny, like crypto is obviously down bad right now, comparatively speaking, over the last few months. But every single headline, aside from like the Bybit hack, has been tremendously bullish. But the market just doesn't care.
Oh, 100%. Like this is where, you know, last year everything was doing extremely well. Bitcoin had great news, but largely it was getting pulled up on account of its beta to the broader risk asset market. And now that beta is working in the opposite direction, right? You know, bad news, slightly middling to bad news on the economic data front. Bad news on, you know, the inflation front, you know, fighting tariffs and things like that. As a result of that, even though, you know, Donald Trump's out here bull posting about a crypto reserve, even though some of the assets in it are a little questionable that he mentioned, Bitcoin's still, everything's still down, right? And I don't think my block clock behind me is actually working. I think the price of Bitcoin right now is, let's see, 83. Okay, so it is working. It wasn't working yesterday. Must have reset overnight. But you're exactly right. Yeah, no, now those tight cross-asset correlations are pulling everything down. That high beta is working against it. Speaking of, and then I want to talk a little bit about the SEC, because there's been a lot happening over there, is Trump's Truth Social post on Sunday. I believe you saw it. It said something to the effect of my working group that I put together in the executive order is now establishing a U.S. crypto reserve, which will include, and then he said, XRP, SOL, and ADA. Notably, in the first tweet, at least, excluding Bitcoin and Ethereum, which are the two largest assets, he then went on to quote tweet it or quote truth it, I'm not sure, with Bitcoin and Ethereum. He said, also these two, I love these two. All three of those coins went on to pump. And then over the next 18 to 22 hours, they were back completely flat. So to me, well, what do you think about, you know, what are the implications of this? First of all, what do you think about a post like this? David Sacks came out afterward, did a little bit of damage control and said, hey, this thing's going to be centered around Bitcoin. Don't worry. But do you think a tweet like this has any material impact? Do you think this tweet seems even organic? Loaded question there, but I have a follow-up question after it.
Yeah, I mean, one of my colleagues on our podcast, Alex Krueger, basically said this seems like the Trump put on crypto. Like, he came in on Sunday in an illiquid market and basically, like, for those that don't know, the Fed put is basically like the Fed puts a stop under the market at some price level. And it seems to be that's almost like what Trump was doing with that tweet. It was like, really, I don't know. I don't know how planned it was. I don't actually know. I'm personally somebody of the opinion that I don't really love the idea of a Bitcoin strategic reserve, particularly one that's done like out of the executive branch of the U.S. government. I would get behind it a little bit more if like it came out of Congress, like a Cynthia Lummis bill that's out there. If they want to go that route, I think that's the correct way to do it. I don't really like the idea of putting other assets beside like one. Like I said, I'm not really even a huge fan of a Bitcoin strategic reserve. Personally, I don't think it's needed. But adding all these other assets, ETH, Sol, Cardano, XRP. I'm just not a fan. Like at that point, why aren't we just buying tech stocks? That is the way I think about it, which is not a, and basically this is the consensus opinion. You look at key opinion leaders, you look at thought leaders in the crypto space, CEOs, pretty much everyone, even people like I cover the ETF world, obviously, mostly, and Bitwise is one of the larger managers. They've been involved in crypto. They've had index funds since long before we could get ETFs. And even those guys are like, come on, this like, let's Bitcoin makes the most sense. His predecessor, I mean, successor to gold, you know, all these things. That makes a little more sense. These other things, for the most part, it doesn't seem like anyone is really behind putting all these other assets in there. So that's where I kind of sit personally. The other thing is the U.S. is already heavily exposed to this in the sense that you have to pay long-term capital gains, short-term capital gains when you're trading these things. The U.S. persons hold a lot of these assets. There's a lot of companies here. So the U.S. government's already getting their tax receipts that would be, you know, heavily correlated to this market as it is. Mm-hmm. And I just don't know how great of an idea it is to, like, I don't know, you have Doge out here talking about saving all this money. They're trying to create government efficiency. They're firing people. They're offering payouts to a whole bunch of different people across the government jobs, and then they're gonna like, we're gonna take a bunch of taxpayer money and buy crypto with it. Like, Elizabeth Warren never had an anti-crypto army, which is part of the reason why she failed. But like, if you start taking taxpayer money, you're canceling all these other things, and you go out and buy crypto, you might actually create a pseudo anti-crypto army, is another thing I would say. So I don't know. I think it should be Congress that does it. I don't like the idea. I mean, maybe he could do it via the Exchange Stabilization Act, which you could be done through Treasury, which is kind of like via Trump. I don't know exactly how he would do this. I'm very skeptical. I get the idea of like wanting to see, but I think like part of the problem is like you look at this last admin and like what everyone in crypto wanted was like just stop attacking the good actors. Go after people doing fraud, but stop going after people trying to do things the right way. Work with us, create a framework. Stop attacking us. Let us build. Give us rules of the road. And everyone's like, oh, we're finally getting that. And then we swung like with the Trump meme coin, the Melania meme coin, and now like this like crypto asset reserve thing. And it's like, all right, maybe we're swinging a little bit too far to the other side of the pendulum. So I don't know. There's a lot of risks here. Ironically, like you said, everything's giving it back. And I don't know if people are just skeptical that he's going to be able to get it done, but we'll see.
100%. Yeah. No, and we'll talk about the SEC. One of the main things that gives me pause, Joe Weisenthal wrote his recent newsletter. I saw you retweeted. I read it. There seems to be some sort of highly inorganic epidemic. And you don't have to comment on this because I don't know what you can say and can't say. But this is what I will say. This engagement around all of these three altcoins in particular, especially XRP, seems to be highly inorganic. It seems that whenever I make a post about like XRP BTC, on the terminal or TradingView, because Bloomberg's doesn't go back that far, or I make one about, whatever, I put XRP in the title, all of a sudden, you know, my little account of 40,000 followers is flooded with like 500 comments of people who have like 20 followers and 30 followers. And it just seems highly inorganic to me. And then you pair that with how much Brad Garlinghouse donated to the Trump administration and how much he also spent to kind of create these like Bitcoin attack campaigns through Greenpeace. And, you know, the puzzle pieces in my head aren't fitting together all that well. But loosely, I believe there's some kind of coordinated multi-million or billion-dollar astroturfing campaign of sorts to create kind of this inorganic engagement. And the Trump tweet, in my eyes, was him fulfilling a promise to donors rather than, like, you know, seriously saying, hey, we're going to build a reserve of these things. And then on the executive side, I completely agree with you. I think that the right way to get this done is through Congress. I think Lummis, you know, when she introduced the bill, and actually I was honored to give the first or take the first interview from her when she introduced the bill. We had scheduled it ahead of time. She sent it to me and my colleague, Nick. We had read it. The moment it launched, she came on our show. And speaking to her about it back then, the logic behind it was sound. And, you know, even now my thinking on it, and I think you'll agree with this, is that, like, obviously we have a strategic petroleum reserve, right? You know, for geopolitical risks and to, you know, hedge against price volatility and things like that for times of crisis. We have a gold reserve for, you know, monetary debasement, right? We kind of hold that ceremonially now because we haven't even valued it at today's prices. But nevertheless, that was the reason why we held it, to keep some sort of tie to scarcity for our money, to, you know, to a real asset. Bitcoin would kind of fall into that exact same bucket. But then you kind of try to think of the strategic importance of everything else. And it's exactly as you said, why not just buy tech stocks? Why doesn't the US just buy Nvidia or Apple, right? It doesn't make a lot of sense what Trump is trying to do. It sounds more like huckster marketing to help his friends out. Whereas what Senator Lummis is trying to do is actually trying to push Bitcoin forward as a tool that has high strategic importance for the United States. I don't know if you share thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, like, even the one thing this has done is it's kind of like put, like, true crypto believers and people that are put their whole, like, life and companies behind crypto or Bitcoin, what have you. Even the people who are, like, Bitcoin maxis are on the side. Even, like, people who are altcoin maxis, in a way, are kind of, like, against this. The people who are anti-crypto in general are, like, everyone's kind of in agreement that, like, this doesn't make a lot of sense, I guess. It's kind of unique in the sense this is united, like, warring factions. I mean, even Peter Schiff, who has been anti-Bitcoin, was like, I at least get the argument. Like, I don't believe it. I don't agree with it. But I get the argument for a Bitcoin reserve. He's like, I don't get these other things. The way my framework for this space is, I kind of think about all these other coins as, like, more technology plays. Like, even if you listen to some of these ETF issuers, the way they talk about the Ethereum ETFs versus the Bitcoin ETFs is, like, Bitcoin ETFs, a hedge against current debasement, potential the successor as digital gold, all these different things about what you could do to add Bitcoin to a portfolio. When they tend to talk about Ethereum, some of these other coins, it's more like these are technologies. These could be backends to the future of finance. These things along those lines. It's like a little bit of a different argument. I know some people in the ETH world would say, you know, ETH is money and things like that. But for the most part, I think people kind of think of those things as more technology plays and along that front. So that's kind of the way I tend to think about it. Bitcoin isn't really competing on that front in my mind, obviously. The one caveat I would say that in defense of this reserve would be, like, this is basically just taking the top 10 coins, stripping out the Tether, USDC, and Binance's BNB, which it makes sense, obviously, very, very, very tied into China in many ways. Like, it's basically just taking the top assets. The problem with, like, what you're talking about, Joe Weisenthal's node and a few other people is, like, okay, Solana and Ethereum have a lot of usage. Like, you can see the on-chain data. Mm-hmm. Bitcoin, obviously, is Bitcoin. And then, but the problem is XRP and Cardano, however good the tech may be, I'm not even going to comment on that. Like, the usage is just nowhere near the level of the others. But their market caps, they're pretty high up there. And XRP is even bigger than Solana as far as market cap goes. So I guess, like, if you're just trying to go the index fund route, which is, we already have some of those out there. Grayscale has a product. Bitwise has products out there that are trying to convert to ETFs. Like, these are the coins they hold. So if you're just going to go and hold the biggest things, whether or not they're based in fundamental value, which I don't know how you, it's very hard to ascribe fundamental value in the crypto space, though plenty of people are trying. That would be the defense that I would make for why they would go this route. But again, like I said, I'm generally speaking, not a huge fan of it. I don't think the government needs to be involved in this process. And like I said, and like you said, I'd prefer it goes down the avenue of Congress.
Absolutely. Let's shift gears to another aspect of the new administration, the SEC, completely overhauled. You know, it seems like it, literally, you know, a month and a half, a month and some change, we went from, nonstop attacks, right, to now it seems like they're working overtime to kind of take away a lot of that regulation by enforcement. That was kind of the MO for the SEC as it pertains to crypto and the prior admin. Coinbase tweeted a couple of days ago. They said, case dismissed, time for fair legislation in this industry. You know, they put out staff guidance on meme coins and basically said these aren't securities. So, you know, what's going on at the SEC? What has changed? What has happened in the last several weeks? And what does this mean for the industry as a whole?
I mean, there's like literally one word that answers this question. Well, the simplest way that I could do it in one word is Trump. Trump winning the election is what changed what was going on at the SEC. Prior to the SEC, you had the way the SEC works. It's a 5-member commission. Usually it's 2 of each party, theoretically. So basically the Republicans or the Democrats get to choose at least 2 people. And then whoever's in power gets to choose the chairman. In that case, it was Gary Gensler. Gary Gensler was extremely hostile to the entire crypto industry. Like you said, regulation via enforcement, that is not how things are supposed to be done. The SEC is supposed to be a disclosure regulator, not a merit regulator. So theoretically, they shouldn't be saying this investment has merit. It's just like you need to disclose everything that could go wrong or right with this asset and blah, 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 all the risks, everything you can imagine. As long as that's disclosed, it's fair game. And that's the way the SEC should have been operating. Now, Hester Peirce and Mark Uyeda, who were at the SEC under Gensler, they issued dissent after dissent after dissent, basically saying they didn't like the way that Gary Gensler and the Biden admin were handling this space. I think for the most part, I felt like I was taking crazy pills reading some of the actions that the SEC was doing. They basically were not giving any sort of guidance whatsoever. They were not engaging with the market. That's the way things are supposed to work. And they were going after like genuinely good actors in the space. Like you had Coinbase coming in constantly trying to find ways to register. You know, you had a lot of these different ETF issuers spending like, I mean, we're talking like hundreds of pages of like in-depth pricing research about the correlation of markets and the futures markets and interpricing dynamics. Like this was real in-depth quant research, like down to like really minute details. Like I work at Bloomberg and I had a pretty hard time internally getting the data to like back up some of the data I was seeing in those filings because I didn't want to just be like, well, Bitwise and Fidelity said this is what the correlations are. And I just took it. So I was like, I need to get to this like minute by minute data of the futures market and the spot market and try to do it myself. And it was hard. I had a hard time getting the data going back far enough because you have to go through all these extra processes. It's not something you can just do on the terminal. Mm-hmm. So that's all one thing. I just think the SEC handled it improperly. Now the SEC is dropping a lot of these cases. They are going to continue to go after fraud and market manipulation, things along those lines. Obviously, Hester has basically written all these letters. We have the crypto task force. She basically admits that we need to untangle this mess that was created because it was not consistent. Like the way they were filing these lawsuits, a lot of the things didn't make legal sense, which a lot of judges, like when you have a whole bunch of judges saying like different things and ruling differently, that means there's a lot of confusion about how this should be handled, right? But the SEC under Gensler was like, no, these are all securities. This is a security. It's clear as day. And then you have one judge saying another thing. You have another judge coming up with a different thing. And it's like, so obviously this isn't simple. But they weren't working with them. And I think going forward, that's what's going to happen. What really needs to happen is you need Congress to come in with a market structure bill about like where the delineation between security and commodity is, where the CFTC ownership of something ends and where the SEC's ownership begins or where they overlap. So like you need a lot of clarity here that we just don't have. So for now, it seems like we're going to get these like guidance measures from the SEC, likely from the CFTC about how these things are going to work until we get some sort of, you know, congressional bill explaining this. But right now, it seems like the SEC is going back more towards a libertarian approach. We don't have Paul Atkins in as the chairman yet. So he should come in and that's who Trump has selected. We'll see when he gets in. And it's going to be a little more libertarian minded. It will be very interesting to see where they draw the lines on different things. Like, I don't think everything's going to get through. Like, we have filings for a 2x Melania meme coin ETF. Like, will that get through? Maybe. I don't know. I just don't think that, like, as much as Hester is very, like, liberal with this stuff, I don't know if she's going to allow that. So they're going to draw a line somewhere. It'll be interesting to see where we go. But I think this is just a better way for things to be handled in this space. And for better or worse, there are going to be bad outcomes. There are going to be weird things that are launched, weird things that happen with the SEC. But I think it's better than, you know, completely hamstringing people who are trying to be good actors in this space.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, ultimately, like, you know, it's a pendulum at the end of the day, right? You mentioned a pendulum. It seems like it might be swinging too far in one direction now. But ultimately, this is kind of the way that, you know, Bitcoin and crypto cycles move, is that, you know, you approach the top, you get an extreme amount of leverage in there, you start falling back down to earth. The people who are doing bad things, the bad actors, whether they're exchanges or these like derivative bucket shops or even places located in the United States, if they were doing bad things, they go belly up. In 2022, it was mostly overseas stuff. It was mostly, you know, players like FTX and Celsius and the other one, Voyager. But you also had a few people in there like BlockFi. And now that we have a much more positive SEC, a much more pro-crypto SEC, a lot of that stuff may come back stateside. And I think it's just natural. This will probably lead to the pendulum swing back in the other direction when bad times rear their head again. All of these U.S. domiciled businesses that were doing bad things, that will come to light. People will lose money, unfortunately. Exchanges will go belly up. And then, you know, we'll get, I think, more clear enforcement. I think, you know, it seems to me like what they're doing is they're kind of opening the floodgates basically all the way, letting all this activity happen, letting the market play out. And then after a while, when the tide comes back in, you know, when we enter into a pretty deep bear market and these businesses and exchanges start failing, they'll see who's doing bad stuff, what's going wrong, what the holes are, and then they'll plug them up. To me, that just, you know, it seems pretty logical.
Yeah, and the other thing I would say is like there are some things happening in crypto that like I feel like there's like this dichotomy of like crypto is building new stuff but like learning things of finance that we learned hundreds of years ago, right? Like one of the things in finance is you can't be like a trading venue like New York Stock Exchange or NASDAQ and also be the custodian because then there's no auditory checks going back and forth. So like you have a lot of crypto exchanges that are basically their own trading venue, their exchange, and their custodians, and they have all these other products, and they're all very intercorrelated, and there's no like, I don't know, there's not enough checks between them. I think eventually we're going to get to a point where like it's like, yeah, you know what? It makes sense that we had trading venues separated from the people holding the actual assets, right? So I think we're going to get there for starters. There's just a lot of things that we can learn. But also on the flip side, there's a lot of people in TradFi that like just completely dismiss everything happening in the DeFi and crypto worlds that they really shouldn't be dismissing. So like there's a lot of room for this overlap of, I guess, kind of where I sit, where like I know TradFi decently well. I wouldn't say like I'm, you know, some expert economist or finance minister or what have you, but like there's just like this dichotomy of, you know, the DeFi world refusing to admit that a lot of things have been learned already in the TradFi world that you can learn from. And also TradFi just being like, there's a lot of people that I interact with in my day job who just think it's all completely a joke and the tech is worthless and it's just entries on a digital ledger that is worthless in many regards. So there's like some point in the middle where like both of these camps are probably correct in some regards with certain things. Like there's plenty of blockchains out there that I'm sure are going to be or are really are completely worthless. They're just entries onto some random blockchain. Obviously not all of them, but like it'll be interesting to find it out. But yeah, it's just it's been kind of a mess. And I don't know if this is going to be completely sorted out. You're right. It could be like the pendulum could swing the other way, but hopefully with like guidance and bringing people under the umbrella of the rules and regulations that we have in this country that have, you know, handled things pretty well for the most part, obviously with some exceptions. But some of these rules make a lot of sense, and there's a reason that they're instituted in the TradFi markets that would make sense instituting them some ways into the DeFi markets. And also, some of the biggest players in the TradFi world were essentially barred from getting involved in the crypto world despite wanting to. Some of these huge banks with, you know, hundreds of years custodying different types of assets, like they could probably figure out a way to custody digital assets too. So I don't know. There's all these things that like I said at the beginning, like there's a lot of these like very bullish indicators for the space, but as we talked about, like the beta to risk assets globally is just dragging down this, and crypto kind of acts like levered beta, very much so.
100%. I want to talk a little bit about ETFs. I have a chart up here. I made it in the terminal. It's Bitcoin ETF daily flows, broken up. The top is inflows and outflows broken up by vehicle. The middle is AUM in dollar terms, doesn't really matter all that much. And the bottom is AUM in BTC terms. I can make it go back to, let's see if it can go back all the way to the start of the year. Well, while that loads, I guess the pattern we're seeing here, The pattern we've seen now is kind of, you know, obviously we had the Trump pump, right? After he won in November, we had this massive surge from, I believe we were at like 64 at the bottom of that range. We broke out above it to like 72. And then we shot all the way through the 80K range, where we are now. You know, we're kind of filling that gap through 90K and then 100. During that time, you know, ETFs clients of ETFs or these ETFs managed to purchase a great deal of Bitcoin on behalf of their clients, right? All the way up to, you know, 1.23, 1.25 million. But largely, it seems that, you know, their holdings have stayed mostly flat, right, since December. So this is kind of in line with Bitcoin's price. We had a very large net outflow last week from a lot of players. Can you kind of explain the way that ETF investors, you know, operate when it comes to the price of an underlying, and also if, you know, the people who are purchasing Bitcoin ETFs differ at all in their behavior? Because, and I'll kind of say this, in Bitcoin, there's a dynamic called long and short-term holders. It's observable on chain. One of the interesting things is that, you know, short-term holders, they're kind of categorized as retail investors. You know, they bid the price on the way up. And then long-term holders kind of sell their coins to those individuals and leave at a profit. And then during the bear market, short-term holders, right, these retail speculators, they're selling and driving the price down. Long-term holders are buying that dip. It's generally like a pretty clean dichotomy. It's, you know, it's smart money and, you know, not so smart money, right? Where would you say, based on what you've seen with all this data, you know, with the Bitcoin ETF specifically, that these buyers fall into? What is their behavior?
Yeah, two things I would say even before I answer this. One is, I wish we had that data on the terminal so I could chart it. Obviously, I've seen the data. I know
me
it.
Too.
Anyone in this space, I would love to be able to chart in the terminal. Bloomberg just isn't there yet. And another thing, if for anyone looking at this chart, the one you pointed, the 1.23, there's also the dip afterwards. That's a limitation of the terminal, because basically the way to calculate that is like dividing by the Bitcoin price. And the problem is the NAV, the assets and the ETFs are stale from Friday. So whenever there's a weekend, and particularly price moves a lot over the weekend, you get these spikes that aren't accurate. So like, I think the peak actual number is 1.17 million Bitcoin. It's just a limitation. It's one of my pet peeves that I can't do it. So apologies to you as a client of the Bloomberg Journal.
No worries. I was trying to figure it out for so long, and I found this workaround. But like you said, weekends do not work.
Yes, exactly. But so going to your question. Yeah, I mean, the way that a successful ETF category works, it's not all that dissimilar to what we were talking about, the dichotomy between short-term and long-term holders, right? Basically, like, there's a lot of people coming into the market. They're buying. Most of them are holding for the longer term. That's just the way ETFs are. They are trading vehicles, as we saw last week with, we saw like about over $3 billion come out basically in 2 weeks from February 10th to the end of February for the most part. We'll see what happens going this week, but it looks like a little bit of outflows are coming back after a slight inflow last Friday. But essentially, if you look at what's happened with flows on a net basis since they've launched, which includes the outflows we saw from GBTC and a few other areas, they took in a peak of around $40 billion, which is what's showing on that bottom with the BTC acquisition. Obviously, some of that has come out. It's been like 3-ish% of the assets at the point from the middle of February to now. So like the way ETFs tend to grow, and like they're built to take in new assets and they're built to release assets as the demand drops. And that's why they're so efficient. They trade in line with the underlying asset, right? So like as money's coming in, as there's demand, they're going to go up. So the way ETF grows is it's like 2-3 steps forward, 1 step back, because obviously there are things, there's you know, the market tends to be like a seesaw and it's going to go up and down a little bit. And these ETFs are going to see outflows. But over the long term, for a really successful ETF category, which these Bitcoin ETFs have been thus far, that the trend is very clear. It's up and to the right. And there are going to be drawbacks. That's just the way it's going to work. But again, like the drawback, I would say, like, yeah, we've seen $3+ billion come out of these things over the last few weeks. That sounds like a lot. That is a lot of money. But that they had like $115 billion in assets when that started. So we're talking like a couple of percentage points of like money coming out. I mean, obviously that could continue for another 2 months and it will be like, that will be a really bad sell-off for the Bitcoin ETFs. But for the most part, people getting into this, I would hope, understand what they're getting into. They understand it's a very risky asset. They understand it's very volatile. I hope they understand that it has seen 70% drawdowns multiple times in its history. So theoretically, you would hope that people allocating to the space kind of know what they're getting themselves into. But we do know a lot of the holders of these things are retail investors, and we do know a lot of these holders of these things are basically doing this for the basis trade, which I don't know if we want to get into it. Essentially, like, it's a very special situation usage, but what they'll do is they'll sell the futures forward and then buy these ETFs, and that basically generates almost like a risk-free arbitrage return for them in some regards. And when that unwinds, you're going to see a bunch of money coming out. But theoretically, that unwinding shouldn't be a huge price impact, because once you're unwinding, you're also buying the futures as at the same time you're selling the ETF. So it should be delta neutral. It shouldn't have a huge price impact. There's some nuance there potentially, but like, there's a lot of things happening. But for the most part, what we're seeing is a lot of long-term buy and hold type investing, which is what we see across the ETF universe. One of the things that Eric Balchunas, my boss, and I had been arguing with people in the crypto space and people who are anti-Bitcoin and anti-ETF, saying they're going to be soft hands, they're going to sell when there's dips. And yeah, they will sell when there's dips. That tends to happen. There'll also be some buyers when there's dips in the ETF market. But ETF users are like diamond hands people. Like, for the most part, they're buying these things. They're expecting to hold it for a very long time. And that's what this chart shows, as far as I'm concerned. There's going to be pullbacks. And ironically, like I said, 2-3 steps forward, I would make the argument that it was more like 15 steps forwards and a step back and 10 steps forward. Like, this is the most successful ETF launch we've ever seen.
You know, it's an incredibly bullish thing you just said. And just the behavior over the last year, like, you know, from these investors, like, it literally just over 1 year, you could tell, like, these guys are a great new cohort, you know, to the Bitcoin investor base. They're diamond hands, right? You over this period, right, Bitcoin, you know, hit an all-time high right around here, like the 20th. Basically, you know, AUM is flat largely since then, right? It's dipped a little bit, but we've had a 25% drawdown, right, from 108 to 79. And AUM has basically been unaffected. And what have they been doing? They've been stacking the dip, right? If we exclude this weekend, you know, from Thursday to yesterday, or today, actually, which, you know, this data point won't be accurate until the end of the day, because this is yesterday's data. But anyway, they actually seem to have stacked this dip a little bit, right? So, you know, they're proving to be one of the bigger, the more reliable investor cohorts, certainly more reliable than kind of those short-term holders. I want to ask you about ETFs broadly. I can sort this however you want based on where you want to take this. This is the ETF screen. Probably one of your favorites, just super standard. It's all the US ETFs. I also added the Bitcoin ones in here because for some reason I couldn't find them on the default search. So what do you believe right now are the biggest stories in ETFs, whether it's Bitcoin native or not, whether it has to do with flows, whether it has to do with, you know, price trends. What do you have your eye on?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we look at, ironically enough, side note, I've actually helped build this function. Yeah, I'm involved. I'm one of the people, like, anytime we do changes, I'm one of the people that, like, kind of gives my feedbacks, most of which I like, some of which I don't like, but they ignore me sometimes. But yeah, I mean, if we're talking about the ETF market in general, people are buying these dips in the equity markets, as you can see here. I mean, we're down 6% off the highs on the US equity market. And yesterday, the Vanguard S&P 500 ETF took in $1.5 billion, which, like, people like talk about the Bitcoin ETFs and they're going to be the biggest ETFs ever. And people got to realize, like, how big this market is. I mean, this is a $10, $11 trillion market, right, in the US alone. Sorry, globally. My bad. But, like, you got to realize, like, one, that there's, like, this dichotomy of interest in the ETF world. The way we think about it is you've probably heard this. It's a core satellite approach. So what a lot of people do is, in their core of their portfolio, they're allocating to a lot of those ETFs you see on the top of the screen right there. The iShares 10 to 20 year treasury, the S&P 500 value, the S&P 500, gold even. No matter how you slice it, they have these core cheap ETFs that charge like 3 basis points, 4 basis points to get exposure to these assets. And they have this set it and forget it attitude. That's what the market generally does. A lot of these are heavily traded. They're used by institutions because they're so big and there's so many different people playing. There's a lot of people playing, the hedge funds, market makers, your grandmother, me, you name it. Everyone, the mutual funds themselves are buying ETFs and trading them. So, like, there's a lot of cross currents happening. But for the most part, what ends up happening, as we kind of talk with the Bitcoin ETFs, a lot of it ends up being buy and hold, and the assets and ETFs are kind of up and to the right. But what we've seen over the last few years is this huge growth of that satellite portion of the portfolio. And what you see a lot of people talking about doing this, it's like things that are very risky, your thematic plays. I would consider Bitcoin and crypto to fall into that bucket, which allows issuers, ironically enough, to charge a little bit more money because it's more unique, it's more niche, and they can charge more money for those types of things. And that's what people are doing at the satellite of their portfolio. And that's what we're seeing is happening with the Bitcoin ETFs overall. So what's going on in the ETF world is a lot of these creation of these products that are like not just like providing you beta to a market. One, there's active ETFs, obviously. So there's a lot of active management. Obviously, Bitcoin ETFs are providing you beta, but they're also providing solutions. So there's a lot of these different things like buffer ETFs, which are going to protect you against the downside by using options. But then in return, you're capped to the upside over a given time period. And now we have Bitcoin ETFs that are doing that too. We're probably going to have Ethereum ETFs that do that in the near future. We have crypto index funds coming, and they're probably going to do some sort of options overlay on those too. So like these issuers, I mean, and honestly, I saw Grayscale as soon as this announcement happened yesterday. They sent an email, basically one of their products, GDLC, Bitwise has BitW, which holds 10 assets. GDLC holds a little bit fewer, but basically they're saying this is the portfolio that's going to hold all the assets that go into this digital reserve. So it's really like trying to pitch. It's a lot of marketing, but in that satellite portion of the portfolio, the way I think about it is like, I know some people here are like, I'm all in on Bitcoin and crypto. I have 100% of my portfolio there. The way I think about it, the way more people tend to think about it is like, I have most of my net worth, my assets in my investable portfolio in the stock markets, the global stock markets, maybe the global bond markets. And then I take a chunk of my portfolio and I put it in other things. And what a lot of people end up doing is like, they'll trade that. Like that's their way. A lot of people have a hard time. Like, I'm just going to buy this thing and it's going to compound at 5% a year. And then I'll have a lot of money like when I retire. And like, that's too boring for some people. What they do is with the satellite, they'll trade, they'll buy things like Bitcoin and crypto ETFs or like leverage products. So there's this huge dichotomy that's happening in the ETF world that somebody, Dave Nadig, who's a famous ETF guy in the US, often he's calling it white hats and black hats. So these black hat products are like things that are like 2x MicroStrategy or, you know, leverage single stock ETFs. There's this growing umbrella intent of what includes an ETF. And there's a lot of really unique, highly risky things. So the one thing I would say for anyone out there, if you're like interested in the space, just make sure you know what you're owning. Make sure you know your risks. Like for example, this year to date, I haven't checked in the last couple of days, but as of last week, the 2x long MicroStrategy ETF and the 2x short MicroStrategy ETF, they reset daily. All these leverage ETFs reset daily. They're both down year to date. So on a performance basis. So what happens is like when the market is super choppy and sideways and different things are happening, like if you compare them against each other, like we call it volatility decay. Basically, if you go up, you know, the underlying market goes up 10% and then down percent the next day, the 2x ETF long is going to be down even more than the base asset just because of the way it works. So it gets very wonky. We don't need to get in the weeds here, but like you just need to understand the risks of what you're doing in these different markets.
Yeah, no, I pulled this up as you were speaking. This is a chart that Preston Pysh put out a little while ago. It was, I think he retweeted it, but it was, you know, this is what happens, you know, to your, this is what happens when the stock stays flat, right? When it chops around, it stays flat. It's literally just, you know, moving like this flat. But then, right, when you have a 2x long or a 2x short on that, ultimately that volatility decay, instead of being flat, it makes it choppy to the downside. And that's what you've seen, you know, here with MSTU, this 2x long ETF, right? At first, when it launched in September, these insane price returns, you know, going from what, like 250 down here all the way up to something insane, like $91, that drew a lot of capital, or excuse me, $31, it drew a lot of capital in. And now it's nowhere to be seen. As MicroStrategy has chopped around and fallen, unfortunately, this has been the result. And as it chops around, even that short ETF hasn't fared too well either. But yeah, no, it's all about knowing what you own, being very, very careful, doing your due diligence.
Yeah, I like just to put numbers out there, I just pulled it up. So it's actually gotten worse since I last checked. So the 2x long is down 33.4%, which mostly makes sense. You know, MicroStrategy is down, it's going to be down worse. But the 2x short ETF, which you would think should be up, but again, it resets daily, like you talk about, it chops around. It's not a good thing to be in a resetting daily leverage product when it's chopping around, is down 11%. So just be like, there's a lot of nuance here. We call these things trading tools. We call them power tools. Like, you need to really understand what you're getting involved with. I think there's a lot of really cool products that are coming out of the ETF space. They're not just built for, you know, your grandmother to buy and hold. There are plenty of products out there that hedge funds are using, that really complex traders who understand this market are using. Just be aware that like somebody telling you to buy something and looking at a chart, like past performance, not necessarily indicative of future returns, right? So just beware when you're getting into these more esoteric areas of the ETF market. When I first started, like, there weren't a lot of these products that were like really could, you know, a power tool that could chop your hand off on accident. They are becoming more and more common. And I think under this SEC administration, which I said is becoming more libertarian minded, they're going to be, it seems like they'll likely be allowing more and more of these things come to market. And these things launched under the prior administration. So who knows what we'll see coming in this administration going forward.
100%. Yeah, lots more exotic products. You know, the ETF market is now, it's slowly but surely morphed into something that your grandparents may buy for you when you're a baby, in addition to a couple of bonds, you know, 30-year bonds for when you're older, to an increasingly exotic space, right, with these new entrants. So be careful. Do you think that this has to do with the rise in financial nihilism? You know, that I think, you know, we've seen the rise in sports betting. We've seen the rise in like these meme coins. Now we're seeing things like the 2X long, 2X short MicroStrategy ETF, the 2X long Melania ETF that you mentioned. These things are coming to market. Do you think that this has to do with people just finding new use cases for ETFs and wanting to build these exotic products? Or do you think that the demand for these is coming from financial nihilism and this need from a lot of people to earn more money because they have no hope for their financial future?
Yeah, so these products exist like all over the world, but they get the most interest and demand here in the US. And I think that's just like I think it's the American culture in some regards. Like, people like to gamble. And like, I think like people argue like investing in the stock market is like gambling, which is a complete like cop out. That is not at all what this is. But these products are essentially like gambling in many regards, right? So I think this is just, like I said, I think of it, I hope people that are dabbling in these things have a core portfolio that's kind of set up. And if in their satellite, some portion of their investable assets, 10%, they're dabbling in these, you know, leverage products, or if it's more than that, they really understand what they're playing with, that they understand that it's basically like opening a FanDuel account or a DraftKings account in many regards. Like, you really are gambling day to day. Like, you could be right over the next week, like I said, or even year to date. If you wanted to short MicroStrategy, you bought this 2X inverse, which you could have picked it right. But if you don't understand how the underlying works, you still lost money, right? So like, that's the idea here. So I think it's both. There are a lot of people out there that want to trade these things. There's a lot of complex vehicles that you can get out there. There's a lot of ETFs that have launched that are, again, I said, providing solutions. Basically, we have this joke, like, these ETF meetings, these issuers are like, what should we do next? Like, what product should we do? And like, quantitative value, small cap value. And then somebody else is like, no, just add leverage. And it's just like that's what's successful right now. I mean, the NVIDIA, the 2X NVIDIA ETF is like a $4 to $5 billion ETF. Like, they charge 1% a year. I mean, that is raking in tons of money for the underlying issuer. There's a lot of money to be made here in, you know, U.S. investors that like to gamble. I guess some of it is financial nihilism, but this is just ETF issuers giving the market what the market wants. And if they want to keep trading it, I don't know how, maybe if we see a bear market, a lot of these things will go away because people will lose so much money playing with these really, you know, powerful power tools, if you will. But they've been around for a very, very, very long time, and they still tend to be a much smaller piece of the market overall. Like, the vast, vast, vast majority of the assets are in things like an S&P 500 ETF, a global stock ETF, or, you know, an aggregate bond ETF. Like, that's where most of the money sits. It's not in these products. It's just that these products are more spicy and fun to talk about. It's a lot more exciting to talk about what's going on in these things. But also, there's a lot of retail people that could get harmed if they go into these and they don't know what they're playing with.
Absolutely. Yeah, it is more fun to talk about the 2X long Milani ETF than it is to talk about what's going on with the ag. I can tell you that 100%. That's really interesting. Growing trend is sprinkling some salt into the satellite model portfolio. You have your white hats, the standards. You have your black hats, right? You know, the MSTRs, Bitcoins of the world. And then you have your jet black hats, which is the leverage added on top of these products. Extremely interesting. But before we go, James, and thanks so much. This was a wonderful discussion. This will be going live everywhere. X, YouTube, all over the place. What's your outlook over the next, you know, 12 months, 18 months? What are you eyeing? What do you think trends are going to be, you know, as it pertains to either Bitcoin or the broader market or ETFs in general?
Yeah, so like, I'm not allowed to give any sort of price targets, but I'm happy to talk about like what I'm looking for. So one, I'm just... the main thing, like what we talked about at the beginning, I'm really concerned to see like how these tariffs impact the broader economy. It'll be very interesting to see what happens with, you know, liquidity, global liquidity specifically. because that'll impact risk assets broadly, particularly Bitcoin. But in my space specifically, I'm watching for the approval and launch of these altcoin ETFs and these index crypto ETFs. I'm expecting most, if not all, the ones that have been filed. So there's different ways. So that 2x Melania I talked about is like, it's going to use futures and derivatives. That goes through a different process. The spot Bitcoin ETFs go through a process called 19b4. They have like a special approval process. They're the more hardcore. They're going to hold the actual underlying asset and in a spot like wrapper in a wallet, if you will, and provide you exposure to those. We have Cardano filed for that, XRP, Solana, you name it, Polkadot, even HBAR/Hetera, and Litecoin. I think Litecoin will be the next one to come to market. It'll be interesting to see how the SEC ultimately approves those things. So I'll be watching those come to market. I will say, for anyone out there who's like a super, you know, Litecoin or HBAR or XRP maxi, like thinking these things are going to see the level of assets that Bitcoin ETFs did, temper your expectations. The Ethereum ETFs took a while to get started. They have had a successful time since the Trump election. But these other single asset ETFs are unlikely to, you know, come close to what the Bitcoin ETFs did as far as demand goes, getting $40 billion essentially in a year. That's unheard of in the ETF industry. And if you just look at like the size of these other assets on like the crypto world, how big are they compared to Bitcoin? That's probably the area where like you could see a successful level of assets. So, and they don't have to, you know, shoot the lights out to be successful products for the issuers and provide people exposure. I think the crypto index products will be interesting. But yeah, I'm just, like I said, I kind of hinted at like the expectations for the U.S. market and earnings overall were just so high coming into this year. It's going to be hard for U.S. companies to meet that, particularly with all the spending on AI. And so AI kind of has to deliver. So this is I'm a little like worried to see how this goes. But again, you look at other areas where, like I said, Europe and some other areas in the world, their expectations are so low that like, can they go any lower? I don't really know. But yeah, I'm mostly looking forward to see how the SEC grows. I'm going to be watching for congressional moves, namely like a stablecoin bill or a crypto market structure bill. Those are the things that are going to really impact the crypto markets. Then again, we've seen plenty of extremely positive things out of the SEC, out of Trump, and it's not really helping the crypto markets at all. So right now, everything is kind of tied to these to the beta to risk assets in the market more broadly, despite most people would argue in this space that Bitcoin should be a risk off asset. It doesn't trade like one right now. The only time I've ever really seen Bitcoin completely decouple from risk assets was one when FTX blew up. That they decoupled heavily there, and also the Bitcoin ETF launch. So they completely decoupled from what was going on. Bitcoin outperformed in the ensuing months after that, obviously. So it'll be interesting to watch. But yeah, I'm watching for those new assets, and I'm going to be looking to see where the SEC actually draws the line around what's allowed and what isn't allowed. Sorry, I rambled a bit there, but there's a lot of things I'm looking for. And yeah, I'm a little worried about the market and how volatile Trump is making things, but I'm hopeful, obviously, as an American, that things work out better in the long run.
Absolutely. You know, whether it's good or bad, the next year, the next 4 years will be exciting. That's for sure. They'll be interesting. James, thanks so much for coming on the show. Lots of great insights, you know, throughout this episode, especially what to look out for here at the end. Before we go, where can people find more of your work and follow along?
Yeah, if you have a Bloomberg terminal, that's where I put all of my in-depth research and analysis. Plenty of charts. I'm actually going to send you some stuff after we get off here because I have some charts I think you'll like. But on Twitter and LinkedIn, obviously. So Twitter is where I'm most active for the most part. JSEYFF. I obviously can't share everything I write because our stuff is supposed to be on the terminal only, but I can share a chart or two here or there or comment on current news events and things like that. So that'd probably be the easiest way for everyone to follow along.
All right. Fantastic. James, thanks so much for coming on the Thea podcast. We really appreciate it. And yeah, you have a good rest of your week. We'll talk to you soon.
You too. Thanks for having me, Joe.